spanning sea throughout the solar system and extending to interstellar regions beyond. This is the Kevin Smith Show.
Comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
And welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you happen to be, all around this beautiful planet we call Earth. Thank you for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. I'm delighted to be here. I'm glad you're here. I think you're really going to enjoy tonight's show, and what a great way to start off the week. My guest this evening will be Walter Bosley, and Walter is going to be talking with us about something really very, very mysterious. As a matter of fact, I have to tell you, it's something that pretty much blew me away when Walter and I talked about it. But anyway, I'm here because you have a right to know too, and because you matter. And so I'm just looking forward to it. I think we're going to have a great, great time tonight. We publish a free newsletter here. We do that because you matter and because you have a right to know. And it's called the K-Files. Every other week we send it out, and we just sent it out over this past weekend. And it had some really cool stuff in it. Now, if you don't get that newsletter, it's called the K-Files. If you don't get that newsletter, there's only one reason why you don't, and that is you haven't subscribed. Now, it's absolutely free. Totally, completely, absolutely free. No strings attached whatsoever. And you can unsubscribe anytime you want to, but most people stay with us forever. I did have somebody that unsubscribed one time because I made a joke about somebody had some real weird reaction and was frothing at the mouth over something really strange. Not that I did, but I don't even remember now what it was. But I just made the comment, somebody asked me what I thought about it on the air. And I said, well, I don't know, man, they probably got pills for that. The guy got really upset with me because he takes pills every day. And he said that was insensitive, it was an insult, and so he canceled. They got pills for that, too. I take pills, too, by the way. I have to take medication, too. Come on, grow up, right? Usually it's something like that when someone decides to unsubscribe. But you can unsubscribe anytime you want to. And there's no reason for you to not be getting the K-Files. Scoot over to my website, kevinsmithshow.com, and subscribe. Just click where it says K-Files, subscribe, and then you're going automatically to get an email. It has a link in it that you have to click in order to activate your subscription. Now, once you do that, that's it. That's it. There are no other obligations. You don't have to, recommend us to five of your friends or any of that kind of nonsense that you see all over the internet. When we say free here, we really mean free. So avail yourself of that, okay? Make sure you're getting the K-Files. When we bring Walter Bosley on after this next break, I think he's going to blow your mind. Call your friends, your neighbors, your enemies, and tell them to tune in. We'll be back right after this. All of the music used here at the Kevin Smith Show is from independent artists. Most of it from independent artists at musicalley.com. Go over to musicalley.com. Check out thousands of artists and thousands of great independent tunes. Musicalley.com. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. As I stated, my guest this evening is Walter Bosley. Now, those who are longtime listeners here at the show know Walter. Walter's a personal friend of mine, by the way. We met through the show at a movie premiere that I was broadcasting live from movie premiere for Fast Walkers. And Walter had come over to the movie premiere, and that's where we met, and we've become friends, and he's been a guest on the show many times. But for those of you who do not know Walter, he is an author, he is a publisher, he is a filmmaker. In addition to that, he is an expert in counter-espionage and intelligence. Formerly with the U.S. Air Force Office of Special Investigations, and in that capacity served as the Chief of Counter-Espionage Operations at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Now, the reason I'm telling you that and reminding you of it is because I want you to remember, as we go through the information here tonight, that this is not just somebody's harebrained idea, because it's not harebrained at all. But it's not just somebody out there. It's somebody that has a great deal of experience at really digging up information and doing in-depth research and investigation. And folks, I was floored. I truly was floored when Walter shared with me what he's going to share with you tonight. Walter, welcome back to the show. We're delighted to have you.
Well, thanks for having me back, Kevin. It's always good to be here.
Walter, you published a book that we talked about here a couple of times, maybe more than twice. And that book, you didn't just publish it, you wrote it. That book was The Empire of the Wheel. Is that what it was called?
That's correct.
You have a brand new book out, and what is it called?
It is titled Empire of the Wheel 2, Friends from Sonora.
Okay, now folks, keep that in your minds. Friends from Sonora, okay? That book is now available, right?
It is available right now at Amazon.com in Kindle format, and for those who like print, it's available print on demand at Lulu.com.
Okay. We'll mention that again before the show is over, but it is available, folks, right now, and it is, like, really hot off the press. It's brand new. Okay, Walter, in your previous book, one of the main characters, and as, by the way, folks, it's nonfiction. This is real stuff. One of the main people in your previous book was a young woman by the name of Cora Stanton. She is also central in this book.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about who this Cora Stanton was, and why you got interested in her at all. What is it about this Cora Stanton that got your investigator's mind going?
Well, the first book basically is about what I think were some serial murders in 1915 San Bernardino. And Cora Stanton was the central figure in these seven curious deaths. I wrote this first book with Richard Spence, who is a professor of history at the University of Idaho, and he and I agreed that Cora appears to have been sort of the star of the show, the belle of the ball. She's a woman who was a complete stranger to San Bernardino. Again, this is back in 1915, 98 years ago. She shows up in town, a complete stranger, and she goes into a doctor's office briefly and then walks out before the doctor sees her, and the receptionist is the only witness to her being alive. And by the next morning, she's found dead, floating in a lake in a city park. And nobody knew who she was. The labels from her clothing were torn off or defaced. She had no purse. She left no suicide note, anything like that. She was a complete mystery, an enigma, for a couple of weeks until a man stumbles upon a purse and a suicide note, and this is determined to be hers. But it was found in a place that had been searched already. So the whole thing was very odd, very questionable, and this alleged suicide note of hers identified her as being named Cora Stanton from El Paso, Texas. Well, for those that are familiar with the first book, they know that there's a lot of mystery and strangeness surrounding this woman and a lot of esoterica. And I first heard about this when I was doing some follow-up research to my Disneyland book, and a local librarian by the name of Ann Walker told me about a ghost story associated with a local mall. And the mall was built on the site of where the lake used to be, and Ann was the one that introduced me to this woman, Cora Stanton. And when I went to look into this further in the newspapers of the day, that's when I discovered all this mystery and these other deaths and such. So she was quite a fascinating character to me from the beginning.
Okay, now she allegedly had committed suicide.
That's what a jury of six men just determined, and this was before any suicide note was ever found.
They determined this how quickly after her discovery of her body?
Oh, just days, I think, within a week or less.
Mm. Okay, so we really don't know that she committed suicide. That's right.
That's not
at all certain.
That's right. Rick and I, Rick Spence and I, in the first book, we pretty much propose our conviction that she did not commit suicide. She was most likely murdered.
Now, when she was found, I remember talking about this case. Actually, as you were researching it, you and I talked about this case and the evidence. Gracious, that seems like ages ago. I was still broadcasting from the Phoenix, Arizona area back then.
Yeah, it was 2008 before I learned about Cora Stanton. And mm-hmm. So that's how far back this I've been investigating this whole mystery.
Mm-hmm. And I don't remember all the details now, but I do remember at the time as you described for me the scene and as you did, you know, where she was found, how she was found, and the mm-hmm. whatever markings on her body and things like that. It did not sound to me like suicide. But and I remember expressing that to you, that I didn't think, you know, it certainly would cause me to raise an eyebrow, and as an investigator, I would want to go further and find out more. It didn't sound to me like suicide, which is curious that within a few days you have a jury of six men who say, yep, it was suicide.
Right.
But now there's also an interesting thing that happened right after they found this purse, that how they determined it was hers, who knows. But they found the purse. It has a suicide note in it. It identifies her as Cora Stanton. And as soon as she is identified as Cora Stanton, a guy shows up and says, yeah, I know her. That is Cora. Tell us about
that. Yes. In fact, within an hour of the discovery of her alleged purse and suicide note, this man walks into the mortuary where she's being kept and claims to know her. He by the name that's in the suicide note, and he knows that she's, you know, went to El Paso, and he claims he knew her in Iowa. And what's interesting is they go to show him the body, and they say that he doesn't or can't identify the body, and then he abruptly departs before the police can arrive and question him. Well, what little he told about himself, the police followed up on and found that it was all bogus. Nobody in the city where he said he was from knew him or where he worked knew him, and they were never able to trace him by the name he left. And so he ends up being as big a mystery as Cora Stanton herself.
Now, what year was this? 19 what?
1915.
Uh-huh. Okay, so 1915
mm-hmm.
is kind of a pivotal year in
Indeed.
This story. All right, now the guy, folks, understand, in 1915, you didn't have radio and TV news like you've got now. You didn't have radio and TV. You might have had some very, very primitive radio, but you didn't have radio programming in 1915. And I, as a matter of fact, I think it was about 1920, 21, somewhere in there, when the first radio networks really started up. Isn't that right, Walter?
Something like that, yeah. 1915, you didn't.
Yeah, it wasn't available.
Newspapers.
So you had newspapers, which didn't. There's no way that they rushed a story into the newspaper and got it printed and distributed to everybody in the city within that first hour. You didn't have internet. You didn't have telephone. Look, how did this guy know within the hour to walk in there and say, yes, I knew Cora Stanton? The only way, as far as I'm concerned, as an investigator, is he had something to do with planting the purse. He knew something about the purse. But your investigation may have turned up something else, and we'll get into that. All right, so why, after you wrote the first book, Empire of the Wheel, why did you decide you just had to keep going on this investigation of Cora Stanton?
Well, actually, it was a decision because really the investigation is not over. You have to remember that what will be the third book, and yes, there will be a third one, was actually what I discovered first in the fall of 2007. And the Empire of the Wheel mystery involves, as I said before, there were some esoteric elements to her death. It involves the occult and possibly, you know, human sacrifice, these murders as human sacrifice. Those who have read the first book will be familiar with that. So there is this occult undercurrent running through this whole thing. And in my pursuit of that information was what led me, of course, to the Cora Stanton story and what led me to these mysterious deaths of 1915. And I decided to tell the story chronologically. So the first book focused on these mysterious deaths in 1915, which, if you recall, and others who've read the book remember when I was on here before, these were deeply mystical deaths, killings. There was something occult going on, and it involved the what appears to have been the worship of the goddess Hecate and some very dark magic, probably at the hand of spiritualist extremists that were in town at that time. So because I had done the first book just to tell the 1915 story, I want to tell the whole story, so, you know, I continued on with the next book, which would be the next phase of the story. Now, this is a really interesting part, Kevin, because what is going to be the third book was actually just half of what this book was going to be. And what happened was, when I dug a little deeper into Cora Stanton and made the discovery that we're going to talk about here shortly, it opened a door, and the investigation just exploded with new information. And when I pulled that thread, what came to me was so big that it had to be its own book. And so I moved half of the outline into the third book, because what the second book is about is just, it's colossal as far as within the context of the mystery I'm investigating, and actually in the context with its association with history.
Also within the context of its association with, are you ready, folks? I don't know if Walter's even ready. Its association with UFO secrecy.
Oh, yeah, of course.
UFO, yes. Secrecy from 1915.
Exactly. I talk about in the book, as a matter of fact, how this relates to the phenomenon of the breakaway civilization and secret advanced technology.
Yeah. Yeah. And, okay. So, all I can say, folks, is just wait till you hear what Walter has discovered and the theories that he has come to based on what he's discovered, based on his research. I mean, you know, when I say people think of UFOs, they think of 1947 or maybe 1942 or maybe 1938. But they don't think of 1915. And, you know, the secrecy around the technology goes back, we can say, as far, we can document that, as far as I know, back to 1898. But it actually may go back further than that. But she turns out to be more of a star than we already know about. Because, Walter, you, as you dug into her identity and, you know, as much information as you could find about her, you came up with some amazing conclusions or theories. You want to dive into those?
Yeah, right. I think it's a good time.
Well, I'll tell you what. This is a good place. We'll leave everybody just right on the edge of their seats because we've got a break coming up. So when we come back from the break, I want you to go into what you have discovered and then the theories that you have based on that.
Yeah, I will reveal the true identity of Cora Stanton when we return.
Ooh. Now, folks, hang on to your ever-loving hat. You're not going to believe this. This is going to be amazing. All right, we will return right after this.
Galileo, Santa, rob the wheel. Turn your eyes to stars.
And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Walter Bosley. As we went away for break, Walter, you were about to reveal to us what your research and investigation has told you about Cora Stanton. You were about to reveal to us the true identity of Cora Stanton, according to your research and your investigation. So, who is she?
Well, yes. I want you to know that this blew me away. I was not expecting this. This was completely from left field. However, as I pulled the thread when it came up, more and more, though circumstantial, still corroborating evidence just kept popping up, and it blew me away. It really did. But I argue that I am convinced that the true identity of Cora Stanton was that she was at a place.
All right, now you're going to have to explain to people who at a place is.
At a place, for those who don't know who at a place was, she was the associate of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Also known as by their real names, Robert Parker and Harry Longaball.
And more specifically, she was alleged to be married to Longaball, Sundance Kid.
Very much alleged. That has always been an assumption based on a report that was an assumption itself.
Okay. Well, let's dive into it. Why do you think that Etta Place and Cora Stanton are one and the same?
Well, and the book goes into this in better detail than I can do justice here, but basically here's how it happened. There's another individual in the Empire of the Wheel mystery, a man named O.H. Bailey, who was the first death, and he was also an alleged suicide and a bit of a mystery himself. Now, I had identified him a year ago, I propose, that he was a missing millionaire by the name of F. Lewis Clark. So I had gone back in the writing of the book to get some more details of the whole F. Lewis Clark thing, and I opened up one of my missing persons websites that had a list, and I had seen the name, I saw the name at a place there. And I thought, well, missing person, I thought we pretty much knew what happened at a place. So I pulled that thread, and I discovered that after 1909, Etta was a complete mystery. Nobody knows to this day what happened to her after 1909. And then I found something else interesting, is that nobody knows anything about her prior to 1901, when she took up with Butch and Sundance. 1900, 1901, around there.
And what we do know, that we do pretty much know that Etta Place is not her real name.
And that was another thing. Etta Place is not her real name because the last name, the surname Place, was the maiden name of the mother of Harry Longaball, the Sundance Kid. And he had used the Place last name as an alias himself on numerous occasions. So Etta Place wasn't even her real name. Now this, of course, as you would imagine, intrigued the hell out of me. I was just beside myself with curiosity. And then I discovered her physical description in the reports. She had been to a doctor's appointment, according to the record, once. In Denver in 1902, then it was 1906, and her physical description uncannily resonated with, almost identically matched that of Cora Stanton, but of course 9 years younger. When you look at the details of these two women, their hair color, their eye color, their height, their weight, their general build, they are virtually identical, but of course, Cora, 9 years older, a little bit heavier. For instance, at a place was described as being around 115 pounds in 1906. Well, by 1915, Cora is around 130 pounds, you know, 130, 135 pounds. Well, any of us can put on 20 or 25 pounds in 9 years. That's a no-brainer. But you have two women whose physical attributes are darn near identical, but you have the issue of height. Etta Place was described as being 5'4". Cora Stanton was measured to be 5 feet tall. Now, here's what's interesting. All this description of Etta Place is nothing but an estimate and an observation of somebody kind of looking at her from afar.
So it's not actual measurements.
It's not actual measurements.
Uh-huh.
Here's the interesting thing. You say, well, my gosh, a woman 5'4", that's not the same woman who's 5 feet tall. Well, it is if you take her shoes off. See, at a place, the estimate, she was always wearing shoes because it was an estimate of when she was seen in public. Ladies' shoes in those days were at minimum 2 inches tall in the heels.
Mm-hmm.
So now you take away those heels, and you've got a woman who, because her height is purely estimated, the estimate is within 1 to 2 inches of the height of the woman whose height was measured. That's pretty darn close.
Well, yeah, it's enough to make you raise an eyebrow.
So we had the physical description that mm-hmm. just knocked my socks off. That was intriguing the heck out of me. And you had this issue with her past as a mystery, and her fate was a complete mystery. Here's a woman who came from nowhere and then disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
And more, the evidence as the book presents, the little circumstances emerge and pop up, and it just snowballs from there.
All right. What is, I'll use the word known, but it may be alleged. Nevertheless, it is the popular knowledge that Sundance met her at a brothel. Is that right?
That's true. That's true. That is the history. That's the story we are told. Is that he met her at Fanny Porter's brothel in the San Antonio area of Texas. And based on that, it is assumed that she was a girl working in there as a prostitute.
Well, interestingly,
never been confirmed.
Yeah, I read after you and I talked, I went and read everything I could find quickly about Etta Place,
mm-hmm.
and the Wikipedia entry on Etta Place, when it addresses that, says that she may have been a maid or a prostitute.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've been looking at the picture here, and I've been
right.
showing that on our TV channel. The only known picture of Etta Place standing next to the Sundance Kid.
Mm-hmm.
Two things that I would note about this is that, first, let me say first about him, and I want you to dive into his past a little bit as well with us. This guy is way too cityfied in his looks. He's got a hard look in his eye, but he's clean. He's not scarred up. He's He looks like a city businessman.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. She does not look like that she has been working in the trade of prostitutes in that day. Now, I know some of my listeners are going to say, nah, you can't tell just by looking. Yeah, you can. You go back and look at pictures of prostitutes back in the early 1900s. Just do that. Okay.
That
just
was a hard life.
They were tough, and they looked tough. They looked like they had been beat up And, I mean, it was tough, tough, tough. She does not appear to have been subjected to that.
Right.
Now, that, I'm just saying, that's the appearance of the two.
Mm-hmm.
That observation actually fits with what you're about to tell us.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
So, let's switch over and talk about Sundance for a minute. We'll come back to Etta. Let's for those outside the United States who may not be familiar with Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, let's give them a real quick thumbnail of these two guys.
Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, whose real names were Robert Leroy Parker and Harry Alonzo Longabaugh, they are, and I believe still they remain, the most successful train and bank robbers in American history. Of course, the popular movie in 1969 was produced about them, starring Paul Newman and Robert Redford, and it depicts them as the good old boys, you know, clever guys who are just out to, you know, harmlessly rob some banks and trains and, you know, try to live the good life, and by golly, they're just hounded and hunted down by, you know, the Pinkertons, who are relentless and just won't leave them be to do their thing, and eventually they go down to all the way to South America to escape the Pinkerton agency. Now, you got to remember something about the Pinkertons. They were really a private investigation firm. They were not affiliated officially with the U.S. government or any sheriff's office. They were investigators for hire, kind of like I am, as a licensed PI.
Yes, but they had been officially. They had been affiliated with the government.
Well,
because
not the agency, not the Pinkerton agency. Their father, Alan Pinkerton, had been a personal spy master for Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War,
mm-hmm.
and the network that he had set up became the United States Secret Service. Now, the Pinkerton agency that was following Butch and Sundance and other outlaws was founded after that era,
mm-hmm.
and it was a pure business from the start, and it was run by Alan Pinkerton's sons,
okay.
one of whom, William Pinkerton, as my book presents, was a regular at Fanny Porter's brothel. Now there you have the head of the Pinkerton agency, who's notorious for hunting down Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, hanging out in the same brothel during the period of time that Butch and Sundance were hanging out there.
Okay. So he may have known them personally.
Yes, and the book goes into why he may have known them personally. But to go back to Butch and Sundance, the history is that they were just a couple of outlaws that were very successful at what they did. They could never be caught, but they were getting closer to getting caught. And then they up and decide to go all the way to South America to escape the Pinkertons. Now, they could have gone to Mexico, but they go all the way down to South America. And as the story goes, down there, they end up returning to their bank-robbing ways, and they end up ambushed by the Bolivian army, and they are allegedly killed. However, there's no verifiable evidence. The bodies are not handed over to anybody with authority that would know them. And it has remained a mystery as to whether they really died down there. And, of course, there's been stories and legends that Butch Cassidy was seen in the United States and Sundance, I believe, too, after 1908 when they were allegedly killed. And that is the story as we've known it all these years.
All right, we have to step away for a break, and we got more surprises coming up. Hang on, folks. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. Ladies and gentlemen, this evening we are talking with Walter Bosley, and Walter is sharing with us some information about a great mystery in our history here in the United States of America. Just about everybody here in this country knows who Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid were, and have a vague knowledge that there was this mysterious woman that hung out with them and then disappeared. Well, as it turns out, she may actually be Cora Stanton. And who she may really be, which you don't know yet, if that's true, plays a role, in fact, maybe even a pivotal role, in understanding part of the secrecy and the apparatus of secrecy around the whole UFO thing. Walter, tell us a little bit about... Well, I don't know really. I'm going to let you decide how to get into it. But the real connections and background of Butch Cassidy and Etta Place, kind of lead us off into that.
Well, as I said, the book goes into the finer detail, and that's really the best source to get the details. But essentially, what the book presents is an argument based on evidence that I was able to dig up and the analysis of the known history, that Etta Place was very possibly some type of intelligence source for federal law enforcement of the day. Now you got to remember, the U.S. Secret Service had existed since the days of the Civil War, and they were under the Department of Treasury for over a century until our more recent Homeland Security. And the Secret Service, they're famous for protecting presidents, but before that, what they mostly did was investigate counterfeiters and issues relating to currency and the gold reserves and that kind of thing. Now, you have Butch and Sundance, who are known for robbing trains and banks. So it's logical that she was connected with these guys because of that. For instance, working at the brothel because they were known to frequent that brothel. So you get her in there as an asset, as a source, and she gets to know these guys, becomes a trusted associate or confidant, and she's essentially collecting on them. That's a very basic possibility, even if you want to set aside what might be considered the more wild aspects of my research. The historical evidence indeed supports that Etta Place could very well have been just what I spelled out, an asset for the Secret Service collecting on Butch Cassidy and Sundance and their activities. Also, the historical evidence about Longabaugh, Sundance Kid himself, suggests that he may also have been somehow affiliated with law enforcement in some way.
Now you see, you're blowing folks right out of their saddles. How is it that you can have a guy that is one of the most famous bank robbers in the history of this country actually affiliated with law enforcement?
Well, as a source, as an asset, you and I both have been in law enforcement, and we know how this works. People see it in movies all the time. You get yourself an asset, a source, or an agent, and you place him in the criminal milieu environment that you want him in, and he's your undercover guy.
Okay. Do you want to go into the background, his background in Canada?
Yeah, sure. What little there is known, Harry Longabaugh in 1891 worked at a ranch called the Bar U, like the letter U. Now, this ranch was founded by one of the men known as the Big Four, who founded the Calgary Stampede, which rodeo fans will be familiar with. That was a huge rodeo, even historically. The Bar U Ranch was a big ranch. It was the biggest ranch in northwestern territory of Canada for decades. And it also played host to a field post, a field office of the Royal Northwestern Mounted Police, who became the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, the very legendary law enforcement outfit. Now, going back to the 1880s, they had been assigned a counterintelligence task, mission, because of Irish dissidents who were coming to Canada and committing acts of sabotage and other crimes against any interests of England. And they were operating in Canada, so the Royal Northwestern Mounted Police, their officers were assigned to counterintelligence duties. Now, they had an outpost on the Bar U Ranch for several years, and they were there when Longabaugh was there. Now, history says that Longabaugh was highly regarded. He was very well-liked, highly regarded, while he was at that ranch. Knowing how these things work, you got a young guy, they think the world of him, they think he's a good guy, as we say, and perhaps he was ripe for recruitment to work for them. And I argue that it's possible that he had begun a law enforcement affiliation with the Mounties in 1891, working on those counterintelligence issues against the Irish dissidents. So one thing leading to another, by 8 or 9 years later, he could still have, you know, been affiliated and doing other tasks, by this time possibly himself for the U.S. Secret Service.
Okay, so how is it, just kind of, if you can, kind of sketch for us a scenario in which it would be advantageous to the Secret Service to have one of their guys go out and pull a train robbery?
Well, for one thing, undercover agents do this all the time, particularly the guys who investigated the one undercover against the mafia. They were many times present during illegal activities. But if you'll notice, you'll find that there's certain things they did not do. They did not kill people, for instance. If they were involved in thefts, it was always part of their classified reports that they would file with, you know, the agent back at the office that they were working with. Now, here's an interesting thing about, and the reason you do this is you get a guy on the inside for the obvious reason that you learn who all the players are and you learn how they operate. So you want them to be, you know, one of the guys in the group. Now, here's an interesting thing about Longabaugh that many people may not realize. Harry Longabaugh was known to be an expert marksman with a pistol, an excellent shot. This is even depicted in the movie, his reputation. Here's an interesting thing. In the historical record, by all accounts and all witnesses, during Longabaugh's alleged outlaw career, he was never known to have shot or killed anyone. Now, to the average person, that might not mean anything, but to guys like me and to guys like what you used to do, Kevin, that's a flag, because here you got a guy with these shooting skills, and he's an outlaw, and as many times as they were chased and as their gang got into it with law enforcement, because other members of their gang did get into it, into shootouts, here you have a guy that never once was witnessed or known to shoot and kill anyone.
Now, their gang
that
was called
right
the Wild
to
Bunch.
To me, says he could have been, you know, a source, a law enforcement undercover agent.
He looks like a cop.
Yeah, doesn't he? Doesn't you put a hat on him and a star badge on his chest, and you know, doesn't he look like, you know, he could be one of the Earps?
Yeah. He does not have the, now look, some criminals have a baby face, you
sure.
know. He doesn't have a baby face. He has a tough, hard look.
But a man with self-respect and dignity of a guy who's, you know, not on the run and not on that other side.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, in this picture I'm looking at, Etta does not look happy. She's not smiling. But
yeah, she's not beaming.
No, and neither is he. They don't actually appear to be a couple in love.
I agree with you.
All right, so Etta's working at a brothel. She comes out of this she's working at a brothel, perhaps as a prostitute, but perhaps as a maid, which is part of the popular story as well. We have Sundance, we have Cassidy, and we have the guy from Pinkerton, all visiting the brothel, and we have to take a break. I'll pick up there on the way back.
All righty.
We'll be back, folks, right after this. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and my guest this evening, Walter Bosley. And we are speaking about, at the moment, Butch Cassidy, the Sundance Kid, and Etta Place, who was the female companion of the Sundance Kid. All right, as we went away for a break, Walter, and believe me, folks, this connects up with the UFO story. Hang in there. There's more to blow you away. All right, so we've got the head of the Pinkerton agency that frequents this brothel at the same time period when Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid are frequenting this brothel. Prior to that, you have the Sundance Kid, Harry Longabaugh. You have him associated with what became the RCMP, and they think very highly of him. And so he's got that in his history. He winds up over.
Well, he's in the same place. They're in the same place at the same time.
He winds up in the same place at the same time. And Etta is there. And what develops out of that, I mean, look, here's my point. It wouldn't be the first time a brothel was used as an undercover base of operations. I've heard about these things. somebody told me about these things.
Let me remind the audience that what the two oldest professions in the world are: prostitution and espionage. And they've been bedmates, no pun intended, since time began.
Yeah. Yeah, you even have that in the Bible.
Exactly.
Yeah. So it wouldn't be the first time that this sort of thing was operated out of a brothel. So then you have Butch Cassidy and Sundance. They go out and start robbing all these trains. And the most successful train bank robbers in U.S. history. And then what you're saying is that there is a possibility that all of these three characters were, in fact, assets of the Secret Service.
You mean at Fannie Porter's?
I'm talking about Butch Cassidy, Sundance Kid, and Etta Place. You're saying there's the possibility that all three of them could have been.
Here's what I'm saying. There is the strong possibility that Etta Place was an asset of the Secret Service. There was nearly as strong a possibility that Sundance Kid, Harry Longabaugh, was. How Butch Cassidy got into this, the book goes into, like I said, an amazing line of detail on that. But he would have been, you know, associated in some way through Longabaugh.
Other words, recruited.
I'm saying all three of them may not have been what history purports them to be, according to what I found and my analysis of the circumstances.
Okay, so now let's go back to Etta.
Mm-hmm.
Etta Place has an amazing similarity to the description of Cora Stanton. However, Cora Stanton, according to her autopsy report or her postmortem, was a virgin.
Yes.
Etta Place worked in a brothel. Doesn't sound like that kind of goes there.
It doesn't, does it? Doesn't sound like it fits.
No.
Aha. However, this is why I argue that Etta Place could not have been the lover nor wife of Harry Longabaugh or any other man, because I also am convinced that Etta Place, clearly being Cora Stanton, was indeed a virgin after all. And why do I think this, and how does she end up working in a brothel? Because if those who have read the first book, Empire of the Will, will recall that the Episcopal Church plays a role in this mystery, in that the Episcopal Reverend who provided a very public funeral service for Cora Stanton back in 1915, he was the local rector of St. John's Episcopal Church in San Bernardino. Now, his name was Walter Franklin Prince, and he is the man who, with Harry Houdini, investigated corrupt spiritualists. Now, that is all covered in Empire of the Wheel 1 and goes into the significance of that. But there he was, Walter Franklin Prince in San Bernardino, an Episcopal reverend. And what I found out through my ecclesiastical sources was that there was no way that if Cora Stanton, if the church thought Cora Stanton believed she, if they believed she was a suicide, there is no way they would have approved of, nor would Walter Franklin Prince have officiated at her funeral. They would not have given her a proper Christian burial, as it was called. But not only did he do it, he did it in a, it was a very public funeral. Hundreds of people were at this funeral. It was all over the newspapers. So what does that tell us? That told me, as an investigator, they must have known something about this Cora Stanton woman that led them to believe, or they knew for a fact, that she was indeed not a suicide, that she had been murdered. Now, here's the interesting thing. How would they have known that? Well, the Episcopal Church in the United States has a long association in its history with the United States intelligence community. And also, by virtue of the fact that it started out as the American Anglican Church and during the Revolution broke away and founded itself as the Episcopal Church, through its Anglican connections, it also has a long history with British intelligence. Now, if you recall in Empire of the Wheel 1, there were spies all over the place, German, British, and American. Now, within that context, that suggests that the Episcopal Church knew her as an agent. Now, why and how would the Episcopal Church know her as an agent? Because of their affiliation with the intelligence community, it strongly suggests that she had some affiliation with the church. And how does a virgin woman at 35 years old have an affiliation with most churches? I argue that Cora Stanton was a nun, and most specifically, what we call a secular nun. Now, a secular nun is a non-tonsured nun, okay? That means she doesn't wear a habit. That means she's, you know, not a full-fledged, you know, running around in black and white or white like a nun. It's kind of like in the mafia. You have the made guys and the guys who aren't made. It's kind of like that. I argue, the evidence suggests to me, and I argue that Etta Place was a secular nun with, very possibly, an organization called the Community of St. John the Baptist. Now, they came over from England in 1874 and founded themselves in New York. New York is a state that Etta Place is affiliated with. And they are an order, they exist to this very day, and they are an order of secular nuns and oblates of the Episcopal Church. Okay? Now, here's the interesting thing. Here's a real clincher. Here we have an order of secular nuns that now we can connect this woman, Cora Stanton, who I'm convinced was at a place to, and it explains her being a virgin. Here's an interesting thing. The Community of St. John the Baptist, and again, I haven't been able to verify the connection, but this is what sticks out. They are known to work with sex trade workers or prostitutes. That's one of their specialties, is to provide counseling and to help prostitutes. So here you have this order that's been in the United States since 1874, and in the early 1890s you have this woman at a place, okay, who I argue was actually a virgin, who I argue was a secular nun with this organization. There she is in a brothel. That would explain her presence in a brothel without having been a prostitute. It would also explain, because of its Episcopalian status, because it is with the Episcopalian Church, its potential association with intelligence communities. You begin to see, when you pull this thread and you get familiar with this milieu and you know how these things work, as you and I do, Kevin, you begin to see how there just becomes such a preponderance of evidence building here for this scenario in the known history and in the other little historical facts of these associated organizations and milieus that I'm talking about. The case just builds and overflows in the favor of what I'm proposing.
Okay. Now, I told the audience that this very possibly has a connection with the secrecy that wraps itself around the whole UFO phenomenon. And you address this in your book, and it may actually be part of, and may be the reason, Cora Stanton / Etta Place was murdered.
Mm-hmm.
So let's go there. Tell us about Sonora.
Sonora. The Friends from Sonora. Well, let's go back to the first Empire of the Wheel book, in which we have these seven mysterious deaths and these other strange things going on all around these deaths. Now, Cora Stanton is found dead in the mid-late, on the 19th of November, 1915, found floating in the lake. And at this time, we don't know the name Cora Stanton, okay? Mm-hmm. That isn't discovered until November 30th, 29th or 30th. Now, what's interesting is, around the day that her alleged purse and her alleged suicide note is found, a young man is arrested on a train heading out of town. Now, this young man, 24 years old, he, by the name of Frank Rosasco, he is acting very strange on the train. In fact, he's having a kind of a psycho-emotional episode. He claims he's hallucinating the face of a woman who he says unidentified accusers are accusing him of assaulting. And in his possession, he has a lady's purse with a lot of cash in it. Now, this is very interesting. This guy's arrested on the train less than 2 weeks after this mysterious woman is found dead, possibly murdered, and on the same day that another purse is found in a spot that was already searched on the day she was found dead, mm-hmm. and containing her alleged suicide note. This guy's arrested on a train with a woman's purse with cash in it. He's taken immediately to the county hospital, where he is examined, and their diagnosis is that he is having a paranoid attack. In fact, one of them describes him as a dangerous paranoiac. So, wow, you'd think, gee, we got our man here, right? Mm-hmm. With all those details I just told you, and less than 2 weeks after, about 11 days after, this woman's found dead. However, the police and the hospital release Frank Rosasco, and they release him into the custody of unidentified Friends from Sonora. And right. He exits the stage of the Empire of the Wheel mystery, as far as we know at that point.
Okay, question. This purse that he had in his possession,
mm-hmm.
did it have any ID in it?
Nothing is said at all, except it's described as a lady's purse with a little over $200 in it, which in today's dollars is about $4,000.
Yeah. So it obviously has come from someone who's well connected. Etta Place was well connected. She had access to that kind of money. Just from Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
I argue that it was. Remember, this is 1915. Her outlaw days are over at that point. I argue in the book and point out why these were contingency funds. These were operational funds.
Okay.
Is what I argue.
Well, in 1909, the last anybody heard from her, she attempted to have. And this is interesting. Everybody thinks Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid were killed down in Bolivia. But in 1909, she attempted to have her alleged husband declared dead so she could settle his estate. And that's the last anybody heard from her. Is it possible that these are funds from that estate?
sure. It's possible, but 1909 to 1915, you know, that's 6 years.
Well, yeah.
You know, I mean, it's yeah, sure. It's possible that it could be money she made, you know, working as a maid in some hotel or something. What I argue is with the circumstances, the overwhelming circumstances of the milieu of intelligence operatives that were in the area, and all these factors, and knowing what I know about operations and how you work undercover, because I've done it myself. You know, I was given thousands of dollars to just have in my pocket when I was doing that kind of thing, and you know how this works.
I've heard about it. Yeah.
I argue, and the evidence suggests to me that this was the real purse of Cora Stanton / Etta Place, and the book goes into what Frank Rosasco's possible association there would be.
Okay, so friends from Sonora show up, and they take mm-hmm. possession of Frank Rosasco.
Yes.
And he exits stage left. We never hear from him again. So how is Sonora connected?
Well, as I'm looking at this, the flag that pops up with me is when I see the word Sonora, I immediately, you know, think of, but before I go there, let me go back a step, okay? I'm getting ahead of myself here. These friends from Sonora, you know, I wonder, okay, which Sonora? There's Sonora in Mexico, there's a Sonora, Texas, and there's a Sonora, California. And, of course, a flag raises for me with Sonora, California. So out of curiosity, I look up the name Rosasco, and I find a Rosasco family, very prominent ranchers, in Tuolumne County, which is where Sonora is the only incorporated city and the county seat. So there, I connect these friends from Sonora and Frank Rosasco to the Sonora that is the home of the legendary Sonora Aero Club, and thus does the great airship mystery milieu and the legendary NIMSA and all of that stuff enter the Empire of the Wheel mystery totally unexpectedly originally.
All right. Now, when we say Aero, we're saying A-E-R-O, not
yes.
Not A-R-R-O-W. A-E-R-O.
Right, A-E-R-O, as in a flying object.
Yeah. In 1898, there was a great wave of sightings of unknown airships. And you have, and others have connected a lot of that to this Sonora Aero Club.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and then you just mentioned NIMSA. Now, before we dive into NIMSA, I want to point out something that you said earlier in the show, way back at the beginning of the show. When Cora Stanton's body was found, all the labels on all of her clothing were either missing or defaced and not readable.
Right.
That is pretty telling in itself.
Oh, absolutely, particularly if you've been experienced in undercover operations, as you and I are both familiar with intimately.
Yeah, it's sanitizing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's making, doesn't make you untraceable, it just makes it a little longer to do the tracing.
Yeah, I've done it myself. I've had to do it myself.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so no labels in her clothing. We can pretty well assume she ain't Cora Stanton.
Right.
All right, so let's go now back to Sonora.
And it's important to note that not only do we acknowledge now that she was not Cora Stanton, but Rick and I, in the first book, pretty much say that, too. We profess that we doubt that Cora Stanton was this woman's real identity, so there was always a question from the beginning.
Okay. Now, in connection with Sonora, you mentioned NIMSA, which is something I think most people would not be familiar with. What is NIMSA?
NIMSA. Now, you mentioned the great airship mystery of the late 1890s. Okay. Now, the precursor to that was the Sonora Aero Club. Now, Sonora Aero Club is this legendary group that was first written about by a German immigrant named Charles M. Delschau.
All right. Now, let me break in right here. Let me break in right here. For those who are watching, take a look at your screen, and Del Shao's picture appears right above Walter's picture. Okay, go ahead.
That god-awful photo of me, yeah, right above that.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead. So who is Del Shao?
Okay, so this Sonora Aero Club, in a nutshell, was this group of German immigrants, and I think a few Italian guys in there eventually, who came to Sonora, California in the 1850s, the decade before the Civil War, and they were engineering and constructing and flying these aero machines, A-E-R-O. Now, these flying machines, according to Del Shao, they worked on what is essentially an anti-gravity technology. Now, this was in the 1850s. It's a wild story, absolutely amazing. Now, they were one of many, according to Del Shao, one of many of these groups in the United States that fell under the aegis of this mysterious organization called NIMSA. Now, NIMSA is spelled in an acronym, all capital letters, N-Y-M-Z-A. That's how Del Shao spelled it out. Nobody knows for sure, has ever known for sure, what NIMSA was, other than what Del Shao said. There has been proposed that it was a New York-based organization because some of the investors had been identified as being wealthy men in New York.
Plus you had
but
NY.
Del Shao himself said that they were headquartered in Germany and funded by German money. Now, I was very curious about the NIMSA and its true identity because of the whole milieu of what was going on in 1915 and what I was seeing as a pattern with the whole German presence. And that's what led me to make my attempt at translation of NIMSA and the discovery I made and what I propose in the book is the accurate translation of NIMSA, revealing its true identity.
All right, so you've been able to decode what NIMSA really means, right?
I believe so. I'm convinced that I have, and I've thrown it past an expert consultant who's better at specifically the German language than I am. Now, my background in languages, by the way, is, you know, I studied in college, you know, took college French, but also I was a language specialist for the FBI. I studied Russian. I was taught, you know, linguistics and such. I have an aptitude for this. When I studied, I ended up studying Russian for the Bureau because as a Bureau employee, as a surveillance operative, I had taken the language test on a lark, and I scored the highest in the San Francisco division of anybody else who took it. So I had a very strong aptitude for languages. I get the basics of linguistics and etymology, so I kind of have a background in this. I didn't come at it blindly.
Okay, and we have to take a break, and when we come back, we'll pick up right there, all right?
Okay.
We'll be back right after this, folks, so don't go away.
Thank you.
All right, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're talking with Walter Bosley, and this is really now just, I mean, it's been interesting from the beginning, but it's really about to get into the mysterious here. All right, Walter, we're talking about Sonora. We're talking about NIMSA. And can you, do you want to talk about who they are?
Absolutely.
Who are
they? Now, you'll have to forgive my pronunciation, okay? I'm not a native German speaker, obviously. But NIMSA is an acronym, N-Y-M-Z-A, and it is actually a transliterated acronym. Now, what is transliteration? In a nutshell, in a simple way to put it, transliteration is when you provide a spelling of a word in a language foreign to yours, okay, and that spelling is not the actual spelling in that language's native alphabet. It is a spelling in your own alphabet so that you will pronounce the word properly. In other words, if you wanted to, Russian uses the Cyrillic alphabet, which is different than ours in English, So what you would do is, if you wanted to translate a Russian word...
The backwards are, you would in English put YA for YA.
For what? I'm sorry.
The reversed R in Cyrillic.
Yes, you would use a YA. Very good. Yeah. Exactly. Thanks for coming up with that handy example. Exactly. And you would use a YA when actually in Cyrillic it's the backwards R, but the sound is YA. Uh-huh. So this is what transliteration is. I argue that the NIMSA acronym that those of us who know about this airship mystery and the Sonora Aero Club is Charles Delschau, German immigrant. It was his attempt at transliterating the pronunciation of an organization that was actually called NIMSA. And I'm going to explain that distinction here. NIMSA, N-Y-M-Z-A. I won't bore you with the whole train of thought I went through. That's in the book. But essentially, what I argue it is it's actually supposed to be a J, not a Y.
Which, by the way, in German, the J would have a ya sound.
Yeah, it sounds like a ya. Exactly. Now, here's the translation in German, the best I can pronounce it. It is the Nationalistisch Jagdflugzeug. Jagdflugzeug Maschinen Zahlungsamt. Now, Zahlungsamt is put together as one word, but it's actually the AMT is it means something, but it's shoved with Zahlungs as one word.
Okay.
So the what is this Nationalistisch Jagdflugzeug Maschinen Zahlungsamt? It is, in the best in a literal translation, the most literal translation that I was able to get from my consultant who consulted native speakers, it is the Nationalist Hunting Flying Object Payment Office or Department. Now, how would we translate that, actually, for our convenience? And my German consultant specialist is going to beat me over the head for this, but I've got to make it understandable to this audience. This is what we would call the Nationalist Pursuit Airship Finance Office. The Nationalist Pursuit Airship Finance Office. Okay? What does that mean? This would be like the what we call a black program. This would be the office, like out at Skunk Works or whatever, that engineers, finances, and builds and operates these airships. And it was based in Germany.
And was it a government thing?
No, it was a private entity, and it's good you brought that up, because there's the distinction. If it were a government thing, it would be national. But let's remember, we're talking about the 1850s, and in the 1850s, there was no German nation as we came to know it. Back then, what we think of as Germany was actually a collection, a confederacy of a bunch of different states. Okay,
And you had Prussia. You had East Prussia.
What there was a Prussian culture, you know, control of this, and it was a nationalist organization. It was private entity, financed by German bankers, and it was for the nationalist cause. Now, there's a difference. National means affiliated with your government, run by your government, but nationalist is a more political connotation, and that's who was behind the NIMSA, pronounced more properly the NIMSA, because the acronym should be NJMZ lowercase a. NIMSA.
Did they have any affiliation later with what became the Nazi Party?
Yes, the book goes into that, and it has to do with the mystics among the milieu of the NIMSA, and that is what I argue was the cause of a faction in the NIMSA airship culture. This secret culture of airship builders, I argue that the evidence shows that there was a division, a faction, and you had the NIMSA, I'm tripping over my words here because I'm getting ahead of myself. The German interest, they split, or I should say the non-German interest, the American interest, they split from the aegis of the German NIMSA. Now, the NIMSA milieu and Germany at the time, we're talking the Second Reich, the era of Kaiser Wilhelm and all that, mysticism was very much a part of German-Prussian culture back then. It was very popular, okay? So you had people that were involved with theosophy and spiritualism, okay, around the turn of the century back then, and they were mixed up with players in this whole airship mystery issue, okay? This is where John Keeley, for those who are familiar with Keeley, where he comes in, because he was a darling of the spiritualists and the theosophists and German mystics. And it is suspected that he was kind of in the way Tesla was suspected of being involved with the airship mystery. He was a guy who provided them with some of their propulsion devices, that kind of thing, for their airships. But the book gets into this better than I can in a nutshell. There's just so much detail that's out there, and in the book I explain this better. But this faction explains why I'm convinced that there were agents of both sides operating in San Bernardino in 1915. Now, I call the sides Team Sonora and Team NIMSA, okay? And Team Sonora were your more down-to-earth, nuts and bolts. They just wanted to build these secret airships and advance this technology, okay, and use it for industry and things like that to do their own thing, kind of the precursor to the breakaway civilization. Team NIMSA, they were the ones that remained loyal to the original German organization, whose players were heavily involved in mysticism, okay, and that was a major difference with. That was the reason for the schism, I should say.
All right. I've got a couple of lines I want to pursue here.
Uh-huh.
And we're going to run out of time if I don't hurry.
Okay.
First line, Team NIMSA.
Yeah.
Very wrapped up in mysticism. Is it not the case that Hecate and the worship of Hecate was pretty rampant in what we call Germany back in those days?
That's part of my exploration for the third book. You know what? I you kind of, when you threw that question at me, that was kind of a big, huge screwball because that was such a huge whopper of a question. Let me finish answering your question about was there a connection to the Nazis. What I was getting at when I stumbled around there with this faction of the mysticism, what I was trying to answer your question, I was trying to say, yes, indeed there was, and it started with these mystics of the Second Reich in Kaiser Wilhelm's era. These are the guys who led up to the days of the Thule Society and the other German organizations, the German mystics, who then founded the heart of the Nazi Party. So yes, that was, I was trying to show you the connection there, and I stumbled on myself a little bit there, but
okay,
because it's so big. Yeah.
All right. But the question about the worship of Hecate in Prussia, in what we call Germany today. You don't know for sure about that, is that right?
Not yet, because like I said, in the third book I return to the whole business of what was going on occult-wise with Hecate, because as you can see, this information with just explaining the airship connection and everything that I found and the whole thing with Edda and all that was so big that this particular book just focused on that, and it kind of departs from the Hecate focus.
All right, let me make a prediction.
The third book returns to that.
Let me make a prediction.
Yeah.
Because of the importance of the wheel symbol with Hecate, mm-hmm. and because of anti-gravity propulsion being talked about, I bet you're going to find that that's right at the heart of this. That's my prediction.
Oh, I already have.
Okay.
You're right there.
All right. Now, here's the other line. I have to kind of set this up, and I'll have to hurry. We have NIMSA mm-hmm. in Germany. It is a non-government organization, probably of very wealthy people, because they are funding black ops research and development into airships.
Yeah.
Okay, probably with the notion that this is what they're going to use to advance their policies and politics back in Germany.
Yes.
Okay. So we have the guy, Dashiell, is that his name, Dashiell?
Delshow. Charles Delshow.
He says that's where the money's coming from. Okay.
He says that's where they are headquartered, and yes, that the money comes from Germany.
You got German money coming to the United States to fund black projects in the United States.
Yes.
You have U.S. citizens in cooperation with this black project and receiving the money.
Maybe unwitting of its true nature.
Well, maybe, but that's at this point beside the point. The money's coming in, and they are in cooperation with the operation. You have then the possibility of Edda Place working for the Treasury, working for the Secret Service.
Don't forget that there are a lot of German immigrants involved in this in the United States as well.
Sure. Okay, you got Edda Place.
Mm-hmm.
She's hooked up with Sundance. Both of them, there are indications, and some strong indications, that they may have been connected to the Secret Service. I asked the question earlier, and I'm going to answer it with a possibility.
Yeah.
Why would they recruit some bank robbers? I have to answer it after this break.
Nope.
And I will do so. All right, folks, when we come back. All right, welcome back. We're on Final Approach. We only have a few minutes left. My guest is Walter Bosley. And, Walter, I'm going to very hurriedly go through this now. You got private, large sums of private money from NIMSA coming into the U.S. to, mm-hmm. to fund black operations here. Whether the people here knew that or not, entirely beside the point. It's coming right. in, it's exactly. funding it. Okay. So automatically now you've got red flags for Secret Service who are currency cops.
Yes.
Okay. So now we have very strong circumstantial evidence that Etta Place was an asset for the Secret Service.
Yes.
The currency cops. We have Sundance, who there's strong circumstantial evidence was an asset at one time for what became the RCMP.
Mm-hmm.
They get recruited, and under this line of reasoning, to go out and disrupt the flow of that money, and to see, you know, you know how this works. You go out and disrupt something, see who pops up to oppose you. And, you know, sometimes interesting people surface. And how was money moved? Well, they didn't have electronic funds transfer. They moved it on railroads. So you move it from bank to bank on railroads. These bank robberies were Union Pacific.
Not
bank robberies, train robberies.
The key ones were.
Yeah, the key ones were Union Pacific. Meaning they're headed west, okay? Now, because the Pacific's on the west coast. So it's a western-involved railroad, okay? Sonora, California is west.
Correct.
So you get the wild bunch together, you go out there, and you hit the trains that you think are carrying the cash coming from NIMSA. And whether there's any cash on that train or not from NIMSA, that's the train you think is carrying it. In other words, that's the train line that you think is carrying it. So if you start hitting that, and the more often you can hit it with NIMSA cash on board, it'll be interesting to see who pops up to oppose you.
Mm-hmm.
It comes out to be the Pinkerton guy. And it comes out to be the president of the railroad. Now, the big industrialists have, not all of them, but a lot of them in this country, had an affinity later, years later, for Adolf Hitler. Henry Ford loved Adolf Hitler, and he loved the Nazis. And he funded the Nazis to the tune of tons of money. Big industrialist. All right, now that was later, but here you have an industrialist, you have the president of the railroad,
right?
And you know he when the governor of the state said, "I can't grant you amnesty until you talk to the president of the railroad," he says this to Sundance, wasn't it?
Says it to Butch Cassidy.
To Butch Cassidy. All right, can't grant you amnesty. You have to go ask the president of the railroad. Well, now, wait just a freaking minute. What does that tell you? The president of the railroad owns the government of the state. So,
or he certainly wields the influence over it.
Well, all you have to do is wield the influence and you own it.
Yeah.
You know, if you can pull the string and make things happen, you own it. And so this whole thing is very, very plausible. Very plausible. You're going to do a Freedom of Information request, is that correct?
Yes, I've begun that today.
Tell us about that.
Well, I'm simply going to do an initial basic inquiry to the U.S. Secret Service, to their archives. I'm going to do it on two fronts, because of my past, my background, and because of my present position as a private investigator and such. I will also be calling their historical division, but at the same time I'll be putting in the papers for an FOIA request on Etta Place to see if, you know, they will admit to any affiliation.
But if that's not with her, see, that's not her real name.
But that's the only name we know her by, and if that was the name she was operating under, that you got to ask is my point.
Yeah.
You're right. That wasn't her real name, but you have to ask. Because the alias, if she were working for them while using that alias would turn up in records.
I'll tell you another place to find out. The Whorehouse.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's not still in operation.
No.
But Descendants are. Descendants are around.
Well, here's an interesting thing I want to throw in the mix. Fanny Porter was born in England, and after she closed down her brothel, she also disappeared from history. Nobody knows what happened to Fanny Porter afterwards.
Well, she may have been, you know, one of those secret spooks, too. Yeah, a secret spook. Yeah.
Well,
there's spooks who are secret, and then there's secret spooks, you know. As you say, friendlies.
Friendlies, people that own bars, restaurants, hotels, or brothels that allow law enforcement and intelligence types to operate in those establishments, yeah.
I've heard about that.
You know, what's interesting, and we don't, and here's the beauty of it, with not having time to go into it, let me titillate the listeners what you've been bringing up. Now that you bring up the railroad and the fact that Butch was told to go to E.H. Harriman, the book provides an argument for what exactly was going on in South America, what exactly Butch Cassidy and Sundance and Etta were doing in South America, and for whom.
Interesting, they went first to Argentina, exactly the location the Nazi war criminals escaped to.
Yes. Yes, they were in the San Carlos Bariloche area.
Yeah,
they were southeast of it in the Chubut in Cholila, and that's the book goes into the details about how interesting and strange their whole South American adventure was.
Okay, tell us again quickly, where can people buy the book?
People can get Empire of the Wheel 2, Friends from Sonora, right now at Amazon.com as a Kindle book, and at Lulu.com, L-U-L-U.com, as a print-on-demand book. It's available now.
All right. Well, I tell you, this blows me away. Because
it blew me away, Kevin, when I pulled this thread, it just knocked my socks off, and my personal sources that I go to, it just blew them away also.
Well, what we have here is the early days of secrecy around things in the sky.
Yeah, and the book goes into that.
Yeah. Outstanding. Hey, listen, I really appreciate you being with us this evening. You don't ever show up and not blow our socks off.
Well, this one, I got to tell you, this is, I personally consider this the biggest thing yet that I've ever found.
Yeah, well, I don't know everything you found, but it's the biggest thing you found that you've shared here on the show.
Yeah, well, wait till the third one. It's coming soon.
Is it also going to burn our socks?
It will. And I will give you the title is Empire of the Wheel 3, The Nameless Ones. But you guys start on Empire of the Wheel 1 and Empire of the Wheel 2 first.
All right. Okay, just stay on the line with me for a moment bring this in for a close. Ladies and gentlemen, Walter Bosley. I told you, didn't I? I told you this was going to blow you away. All right, you want to be sure and go get the book, okay? Be sure you get the book. Also, be sure you remember, we are listener-supported. No advertising. Listener supported, and we need your support. All right, if you have an extra 5, 10, 20, 25, 50, 1,000, I'll take 10,000 if you force me to. But you know, whatever you got, click that donate button. Help us remain on the air. I don't know anybody else bringing you this stuff, but maybe there are. This is the place that for almost 14 years has been doing it night after night. All right, that's going to do it. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do, too. You may call me whatever you wish. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.